Hi, listeners. Amy and Steph here with another episode of Second Opinion.
This time, we're talking to friend of the podcast, Flora, about her experience with PNET, or pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. It's a diagnosis we've talked about before that can mistakenly get lumped in with pancreatic cancer. And we're talking to Flora also about her transition into a surprisingly wonderful hospice facility. Flora is super knowledgeable about her own disease, and I'm so glad she took the time to really clear things up for us and really break down how her type of cancer functions.
Yeah, it's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, and talking with her about her journey to hospice was a total privilege. I want to mention that this is not a sad episode. It's an interesting one, and it's actually really refreshing.
Yeah, it really is. I really hope that you will listen. Flora is just so smart and she's so funny. She's super spiritual and just an all around really fun hang.
Yeah, truly.
Also, you're going to hear a letter in, I think, the next episode of Cancer for Breakfast, where the letter writer discusses her fear of recurrence or progression. And she comes to the conclusion that the thing that gives her comfort and calms her down is realizing that she can handle whatever the outcome is. Like, she knows she can handle it. And yeah. I really feel like in this episode, you're going to hear that firsthand through Flora and how she discusses this time of her life. I think you're really going to appreciate her perspective. You're also going to hear her actually describe hospice as a beautiful slice of heaven while you're facing the unknown, for example.
It's so awesome. So please enjoy this talk with our friend Flora, who you will sometimes hear me refer to by her nickname, Fleur.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Amy. And hi, Fleur.
Yeah. Hi. Hi, ladies.
We have a third. This is actually another episode. We're calling Second Opinion when we invite a guest on to the program. And today we're so lucky to have our friend Flora come on and share so many important things with our listeners.
Listeners of the podcast who have been with us for a long time may recognize Flora's name because we've read some letters and spoken fondly of her. We have not spoken fondly of her experience with PNET. Fleur, do you want to tell us what you're afflicted with?
I have something called neuroendocrine cancer, and it originated in my pancreas. So it's pancreatic neuroendocrine cancer, not pancreatic cancer. Those are two different things. That cancer is really hard to say because I feel like every time I try to say it, I drool a little bit. Like neuroendocrine. So it's the cancer that unfortunately killed Steve Jobs, Aretha Franklin. Like, everybody knows a lot of people who died from this cancer, but they always mess it up. And now we're getting to the point where a lot of the funding is combined for pancreatic cancer and neuroendocrine cancer, which is okay. But I thought it was really funny that the abbreviation is PNETs, because if you say it too fast, you're just like, I enjoy
already
that.
With the dirty jokes. This is great.
We gotta have some levity. So yeah, I was diagnosed with this asshole cancer that not only makes tumors at different speeds depending on whatever the hell it wants to do, it also secretes different stuff. So some of them secrete things that mess with like your ability to produce sugars, and they give people diabetes, or mess with serotonin. So a lot of these things are misdiagnosed because people think they are IBS, Crohn's, diabetes, you name it, any kind of gastric thing, because of how the symptoms change from second to second depending on how much of a hormone is secreting. So it's a very much like a stress-based cancer. And it just makes it really impossible to diagnose and to treat, because you might have one cancer that has three different types of tumors within it that are all doing three different things that need three different types of treatment. I was diagnosed as inoperable because of the location and the size. Sometimes people get, and you can get them anywhere in your lungs, liver, GI tract, lymph nodes, anywhere. People used to think it was a cancer that afflicted like people in their 40s, but they're actually finding that like teens get it now.
Wow.
And youth can't, it, like people in their 20s and 30s get it. It can grow for a really long time without being detected because there is no specific one way of testing to determine if you have it or not. And it's possible that I might have had this in my body growing for a really long time before we knew what it was, before when we just thought it was IBS. And so, yeah. And it can also cause secondary infections. Like mine gave me Cushing's disease, ectopic Cushing's, and that was hormone related with cortisol. And that resulted in two brain surgeries and psychosis on top of my cancer, because of a tumor secreting certain things. There are some like things like sandostatin. They're like maintenance meds that can control things like vomiting and GI symptoms. But some people require things like resectioning of different parts of their like intestinal system. Some people have parts of their liver removed. It's just one of those cancers that there's nothing straightforward about it. And there's a lot of research, but it's so underknown that people don't really shine a spotlight on it as much as they should.
Yeah.
So we just don't get as much exposure as a cancer. It stinks.
When we're talking about this particular type of cancer, when it is caught earlier, it's pretty treatable, right? No. Is that because it's not caught early very frequently, or is that because?
Yes and no, because yes, you can, if you can get all of it or most of it, it helps, but it's one of those cancers that they say doesn't have a cure, and it never will, because I mean, people do have no evidence of disease sometimes, but the thing is that the tumors can change grades, they can change speed, they can change the type of thing they're excreting. They can metastasize in weird ways. They can be co-current with other cancers. So no, it's different. It's you don't necessarily get cured of it. You can have successful surgeries and have like really good shrinkage. There's a treatment called Lutathera, which is like a targeted radiation that has really great success with shrinking the tumors down almost to the point of not being there. But often you're always on some sort of maintenance drug and you're always kind of maintaining. You can live for like 25 years with NETs, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of it with managing it with food and lifestyle. And if you find a really good maintenance chemo sometimes, but some of those chemos are so strong and they do such a number on your body that sometimes you have to stop before your body stops responding to it, because it's just like what it might be doing to your blood counts or, you know, degenerating your bones or whatever. So it's a cancer you maintain. It's just like you're, it's just there. Like it, I call it my asshole roommates.
Yeah.
They don't pay rent. They just showed up one day and they never left.
In fact, I would guess that they actually cost a lot. Not only do they not pay rent.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've been very lucky that I've had Medicare and Medicaid and stuff for a lot of the time that I was diagnosed. But yes, they can really, really cause some financial fuckery.
Yeah.
For sure.
So is it safe to say that you're coming to the end of your experience with NETs?
It's hard to know because things go up and down. Blood work goes up and down. I'm at the place where there aren't any new treatments that my body is set up to take. Like, there's something called histosonics where, well, histotripsy, where they can actually liquidate like liver tumors, which is great news for me. However, my tumors are too big. So if they were small or a different grade, I could be using this treatment that was non-invasive. But unfortunately, I'm just, their technology and the way my body is set up are not compatible at the moment, unfortunately. I've had success with a lot of treatments, but there's a limit to how much you can have and how much your body can tolerate. I've had all the different lines of IV stuff. I've had PRT. I guess it depends, but I would say at this point, we're at least at a pause in the science where we have come as far as we can with a treatment that's not going to be so dangerous to me that it would almost be like, it just wouldn't make sense to have it.
Yeah.
So I would still say my quality of life is better than it was when I was on chemo. That's great. Much better now.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, can you tell us about this pause in your treatment or where you're at right now?
Right now I'm in a place where I'm doing a lot of energy healing. I get Reiki every day. I do a lot of visualizations, do some meditation and stuff. I'm working with people who have training in shamanism. I'm doing my phase of what I call the spiritual part of my treatment, where I've done a lot of the physical, and now I'm working on closure, like emotional closure, stress, the things that were bringing me stress, and reducing them, like managing my trauma around things and kind of resolving the things that I can resolve. And I find that it's healing. I find that it's taking some burdens off of me. And a lot of my panels before I went into hospice were pretty decent. And so I was kind of like, besides the fact that my calcium is like pretty wacko all the time, nothing I can really do about that. Yeah, I would say that I'm in, this is just a stage of treatment I'm in where it doesn't involve any chemicals.
You were telling us before we recorded that one of the reasons that you thought it would be great to come on and talk to listeners is just being in this really unique position that you kind of didn't anticipate and that some of our listeners will face too and will want to know more about what that's like. But you were talking about when your doctors do come to you and say, maybe we should pause all of this stuff and just this time period.
I think, well, what I asked, I said I didn't want to have a prognosis. I didn't want to have like a time because I knew that that could always change.
Yeah.
And they said that a lot of the time, happier patients live longer. So the focus is on kind of like quality of life as opposed to care. And that when I realized that the chemo just wasn't working, I was really upset because I thought it was. And they're like, no, things are growing. But I saw that there were like places where they couldn't really explain what was happening. Nothing really was. It wasn't growing or shrinking. It wasn't stable. It was just, I'd say it was kind of where the faith healing and spiritual stuff was being addressed. But like, I was so bummed because I really wanted this cancer treatment to be working. And then for a while it was. I think my body was just like, we're done. We're not doing this anymore. So at that point I was like, okay, so we're going to stop this and we're going to focus on histotripsy. And I really gunned in on that. I was like, this is the treatment. This is what we're going to do. You know, if we're not going to do chemicals, we're going to do this. I had 100% faith that that was the direction we were going. And they said, sorry, no dice. We can't do it. I was like, okay, that's fine. If I am having fluid coming off my body from my tumors, we'll just get that taken out. That's fine. We'll do that. And the solutions kept just being like, no, 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 pointing to no. And I was like, okay, I'm in a lot of discomfort. I'll do Act 39. And I was like, I'm not ready to do this. I don't want to die. It doesn't feel like it's my time. So we're not doing that. So like all of these things just weren't, they're just pointing to either there wasn't a solution yet or that I was just not looking in the right place. And then some cosmic stuff was kind of pointing to like this faith healing and stuff. And like with the Chinese medicine, I was just like, the problem is I can't really take in a lot of food. So doing stuff that involves putting food in your body, you can't do nourishing eating if you can't eat. And also some of the stuff interacted. And if you're working with stuff that is in a different body system, and you don't have adrenal glands and you don't have these parts of your body that you need, like people find these ancient body charts and half that stuff is not applicable to me. There's not so much point in going through dealing with insurance, doing a second opinion, going to another hospital, trying to travel when I'm not mobile. Mm-hmm. So there was just things where it was just narrowing down and down and down and down. And then I met with palliative and they're like, well, could it be that some of the problem is that you're not managing, like you're not having help managing the pain that you could be managing, that some of your quality of life is due to the fact that you've been just trying to do all this stuff on your own with your partner and under conditions that just weren't viable. Like, you know, you're living in a house that's not accessible. Your partner works all the time. You have to manage a lot of your own pain stuff. You have Tylenol. So I had to get over the loop of like, what can I do for pain? What am I feeling safe and comfortable to use? What's my hang up about opioids? Why haven't people talked to me more about what palliative looks like? Why haven't people explained how these things can be used? And so I got hospitalized and the palliative team came in and I got this massive education on what pain management could look like. And it was automatically changing how I saw my cancer and how I felt because I had such a better outlook when I wasn't in pain. So once we started kind of like looking at that with the medication and how that looked, it was better and different. And then I'd been saying for a while that I felt that I needed to be in a rehabilitation center because we had been trying to find people to do one-on-one caregiving at home and we weren't finding people who were equipped to do it, partially due to location and partially due to medical needs. I was having to go in the ambulance with my chemo giving me like, you know, nosebleeds, and I was having adrenal crises all over the place. And I was like, I can't do this. Like, we can't do this to our kid. We can't do this to my partner who is having to get up in the morning after, you know, being up with me all night in the ER. So when I was admitted, they finally said, we need to kind of like look at this and see what's going to be the best course of action for you. And what are you thinking? And I said, I think I need to be in residential. What would that look like for me? And we tried a couple of different places and I was still tapering off chemo. So obviously, you know, I had medicine I was taking and needed somewhere that was going to be able to administer medicine. And they looked and there just wasn't a lot available. One place didn't want to take me because they thought I was too young. Other places were like, we don't have beds. And this place with really crappy reviews was like, we'll take her immediately. And we didn't have any other choice because I couldn't go to hospice because I wasn't ready to go to hospice because I was still on treatment. And I didn't feel I was ready for a lot of other reasons. I wanted to because it sounded amazing. I didn't hit the criteria yet. We talked about it for a long time. There was discussions about like end of life wishes, whether I thought I was there. And I said, no, I didn't. This is like a really big treatment meeting with my entire care team about like what I was thinking about and what I wanted to do. So we decided to take me off the chemo because it wasn't working, which sucked because I really wasn't ready to hear from everybody that there just wasn't anything left to try. And they took me to this facility, which is basically, you know, rehab and palliative and hospice all in one, but it was lots of old people where I was the same age as the nurses, but it was close to my family where they lived and the price was right and they had a bed. So they took me there and my first impression was this place smells like shit.
How long were you in that facility?
From the day before Halloween to, I want to say, 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Like Christmas had happened, New Year's had happened.
So is the place that you're at now, the facility where you are currently at, is that technically a hospice facility?
Yes, it's a hospice facility. But I, like, if I decided that this no longer was for me, I could just leave. Like,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I could pack up and leave. I couldn't come back, though. You can't, you know, pop in and out. That's not.
No yeah. ins and outs.
Yeah. This is like this is Hotel California. This is Hotel California. Actually, so when I first got here, it's relevant, I promise. When I got here, I heard Hotel California playing when they were like touring me around the different places. And I was like, this is kind of like a poor choice of music. And so I was like, we went somewhere else. And then later I came back and it was playing at the same point again. And so I said something to the volunteer, like, are you noticing this? And she's like, I didn't put this in. Like, this must have been like a volunteer or something. And the volunteer went, no, I was listening to Celtic Women all morning. Another lady was like, I was listening to classical. And I was like, that's really weird.
And then it plays Hotel California for you.
For me.
Yeah, like then, you walk in and it's the theme song.
It was weird. And then I was like looking for a music book on Amazon and it came and like I flipped open the page and like the second song was freaking Hotel California. I'm like, I get it. I guess this is where I live now. But it is. It's like you can go in, but you can't go. It's real nice.
That is funny.
It was hilarious. Funny, I was like, this funny. Is so...
It's perfect.
It well, way to have a sense of humor about it.
It was really funny. I was like, all right, this is great.
What were you told before you actually checked in?
I was told that they're their own hospital, so they had their own staff, own doctors, own pharmacy. There are certain things. They do comfort care, so like they don't do IVs. They don't do blood tests or panels or anything. Like obviously, they'll do everything they can do to keep you comfortable. They'll administer most of your meds in-house. Mostly people don't, like, there's no ER involved. Like, you don't go to the big hospital with, like, the ambulance. This is, like, it. You know, this is where you are. So there's a certain amount of surrender to the trust that, like, if you decide that you are going to be here and you're going to have an emergency, they're going to manage it in the ways that they manage it. Obviously, if you're like, you know, I'm fucking done here. I'm not coming back. I want to go to the ER and spend all the rest of my days in the hospital instead and be done with this completely. They're not going to stop you from going, but that's like, this is it. This is where you are. That's really hard to wrap your head around because it's a leap of faith that you're either not going to have such a big crisis that it can't be managed or that you're ready. Or that like, if you do get better and you leave, that is it. You don't have, like, you can go to a different hospice house, but like every place has the same general philosophy is that you're going in and you're, that's your plan. So I had to be ready for that. And I just wasn't until I was.
I'm just curious how you're managing to keep a sense of control over your own life while you have taken this leap of faith in the hospice house that you're in.
I think by doing just that, being not afraid to tell people what I want, because this is the first opportunity where I've been able to ask for something and get it, like no jokes, no negotiating, no somebody being, are you sure? Or maybe, or oh, we can't do that. And so that's kind of like part of how I do it. If I want a massage and I'm in pain, they will give me one. I don't have to be sheepish about it or embarrassed. They can be like, my arm hurts. Can you rub my arm? Mm-hmm. I want a shower. Can I get a shower today? Yes. I don't like this food. It's too dry or it's hurting me to swallow. Can I have something else? Of course you can. It's 2 a.m. I'm hungry. Do you want something to eat? Yes.
That's wonderful.
I'm sad. Could I have a hug? Yep. I can't count the number of times I've gotten hugs when I've asked. Like so many people have hugged me.
That's so, so wonderful. Is there really an nice emotional support component to it as far as in-house like therapists or small group things or what sort of things?
So there aren't groups because people don't group here. They just do their own thing with their family or lie down. But no, so there's volunteers that are just around to talk to you. They'll be like, do you want to talk? Do you want company? You want me to sit with you? I've had like the LNs, it's the nursing assistants, just like sit with me in the middle of the night and hold my hand while I cry. Like they don't have any expectation. They're just there. Or they're like, hey, do you want me to paint your toenails? Are you bored? Like, which is really nice. So yeah, no, it's been different. I also have had spiritual advisors. I was encouraged to have my altar. I had, there's like a shaman. There's a volunteer who was a death doula. There are people from all sorts of backgrounds, just like whomever you want. And they're all really nice and willing to problem solve with you. And I think the control where it's hardest is like with your family, and they really trusting that, like when you say you don't have need for anything, that your needs are being met, that they're surprised because they are like, are you sure I can get you this? I'm like, no, they've already provided it for me. Like I have what I need. And that's that peace of mind is pretty incredible. I think the one thing that I have to remember is that sometimes because they have so much of their shit together that like, I do need to like leave space to be like, there is something that my partner can do. Like, yeah, you can bring me this thing, or yeah, I do want you to come visit, or I do want you to stay. Cause like, I have so many of my needs cared for that he feels like he doesn't have anything to do.
Mm-hmm.
But also like he's coming from like an hour away. So I don't want to be like, I need this.
Yeah.
Cause he'll do it. And I don't, that doesn't seem fair, but I don't get to choose that. I don't get to choose what he needs. So yeah, I feel like the control is that like, they empower me to ask for what I need and want and understand what's important.
It's really interesting to me that you had to stop conventional treatment in order to get this level of care and to get your needs met in this way. And it just really highlights, I think, how lacking that rehab system is for people who aren't ready to move onto hospice and take the leap of faith that you've taken, or people who are a little bit earlier in their cancer experience. Yeah. They deserve that too. Like, I wish that you could have gotten that at that rehab facility, because you certainly deserve it, just like all the other people there did.
And some places have that. It's just like they don't hear, and there's a shortage of care, and there have been really low standards in nursing homes. People die. Yeah. Like when I left, there was 16 active COVID cases at the other place. Like it was so dangerous. I don't know how, like, I don't know. I was so worried I was going to get sick. I can't believe I didn't. I think there should be tiers. Like, I think there needs to be like something between, like they call it respite, but respite and hospice are different in my mind. Like, respite is a break. Hospice is different. And I think there should be specifically for cancer patients or people who are chronically ill but who need a really high level of support to go. And it's like assisted living, but it's for like younger people who need that extra thing, who can't afford to have a PCA. Like, I don't pay anything here. If I couldn't pay, I mean, there's some sliding scales, but like if I couldn't pay here, I wouldn't be turned away. They don't turn anyone away.
That's
no
really
one.
Nice. Yeah.
Have you been surprised at how this situation has felt to you, or is it how you envisioned it? Because it did come on somewhat rapidly, right? From where you were doing your treatment, you were in your chemo and maintaining to a degree.
I think I was surprised and disappointed and had a lot of grieving to do. I'm still grieving. And it's funny because I don't feel that I am at the end of my life, but like you can't, I think you can stay like the longest you can stay here is like maybe 9 months. Like you can't just hang out indefinitely. I don't know where you go if you don't. I don't know. We're going to cross that bridge when we get
there. I was going to ask that. Like, what do they do if people are kind of like, you know.
Still hanging on. Yeah, I don't know. But I think if you're still
hanging on. It's a good problem to have.
If you're still hanging on at 9 months and you haven't gotten better or worse, I think that there might be other things going on in your life that maybe you finally did find a treatment and could go home. Or maybe you had a VNA round-the-clock nurse. Or maybe you moved to a place where you could be accommodated in a different way.
Yeah.
But no, I think I was disappointed. I think I was confused and shocked about where to put my head as far as, like, what does this look like? What does this look like to other people? How does it feel to other people? How does it feel to me? What it means. And, like, what it means to be in a space that you never thought you would be in. And people were like, you know, like, what did you want? What did you expect out of this? And I said, you know, I think the quote was like, what I wanted is not to be 37 and thinking about my own death. Like, this is not what I wanted. And I am getting everything I wanted and wished for. So I know that I'm not going to be here for 9 months. But it's just, this feels like the most beautiful slice of heaven that I could be in. It's a beautiful place to sit while you're in the unknown. That's so
interesting to me, because I feel like we always hear people saying they want to be at home. You know, they would fight to be at home. They want to stay out of the hospital and go home. And I don't think that's realistic for so many people. You know, you touched on that earlier, saying that, you know, you needed a level of care that your husband wasn't equipped to provide and wasn't fair to your family, and you were being traumatized. And so I think you bring such a worthwhile perspective of someone who is really, I mean, I hope this doesn't feel weird to you for me to say it, but who is thriving in this environment.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is, the dilemma was that I had gotten to a place where nowhere felt like home anymore. I was either at the hospital, or I was staying at a friend's house being cared for, or in rehab, or at Hope Lodge. And home stopped as I knew it stopped being home. My roots got chopped off. And at this point, this is home. This is where the love is. This is where the concentration of the things that I care about are. This is where it all converges. And if that's not home, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Beautiful. You were going to talk to us about how you are not going to utilize death with dignity. Do you want to share a little bit about when the time would come for you, and when your plans for what you envision happening? Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think initially one of the things that, like, kind of told me that I knew that this was an okay place to pass was that one of my dreams was to be somewhere where I could kind of like see the sun and like be on a veranda or a porch or something. I didn't want to be in a loud hospital room or in a dark corner of my house. And that they said the beds have wheels and we could take you outside.
Yeah.
And I thought about Act 39 because I had this like fear that it's called Act 39 in Vermont. That I would just kind of like keep going and just be suffering, and that I didn't know that I really just wanted to like morphine off into oblivion. But my fear was that if I took the medicine and had that last moment of, oh shit, now maybe this isn't what I wanted, or I changed my mind. You can't change your mind.
Right.
And I didn't like, that was unsettling to me. I didn't want to be boxed in, and it was scary. That doesn't mean that that won't change. Because you can still do it here if I wanted to. I don't think that's some control I could have. That's not what I want right now. And after a lot of the talks that I've had with the spiritual people here, and the kind of like the idea of how they moved me ahead in my life cycle into this part of my path. Because they're not calling it dying because it is really cyclical. It's a journey that you're on. And this is just a part of the journey that I would be on. And I wanted the control and I like this environment and it feels safe. And I think that's why I'm choosing not to. I'm also very spiritual. So I think that I've had a lot of dreams telling me that I would know when it was time and that I would be taken where I needed to go and guided, that I wasn't just going to be like left. No one was going to leave me. So I don't feel like I'm going to be left out to dry here. And that's why I chose that, because I told John, like, I want you to be with me. And I feel like in that moment, I will have that choice. And I think I can have it here. So I want to be able to sense and know when I'm ready and have it happen when it's supposed to under the circumstances that I want. Because you don't get any control over how you're born.
I think you bring up a really important point with that, and you did earlier too, but people shy away, I think, from palliative care because they think it means end of life, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it does, but it doesn't have to. And I think it's been so interesting the way that you've talked about feeling so safe and cared for in this facility, because a lot of folks would be terrified of it, right? But it's the opposite for you. And I think pain management has been key to that safe feeling, right? Because pain just can bring up such a feeling of terror in us.
Yeah.
And I think if more people were allowed to explore that idea of managing their pain with palliative care, then they might be able to feel similarly safe and held in an alternative environment. Their house.
And I think having those options for like the choir, because they have singers who can sing here, and having animals and people who are so familiar and comfortable around death is really special. And, you know, fear amplifies pain. Mm-hmm. Stress amplifies pain. So as you said, as much of the pain as you can marginalize, the easier it gets to be where you are, to be less miserable. And I think that's really all we want. I want a good death. I want a peaceful death. I think that's what anybody wants.
Have they been talking to you a lot about what to expect when that time does come closer? Like what, I mean, obviously nobody knows certain things, but as far as like, your comfort level.
I think they ask me how much I want to know. We've talked about spiritually some of that, but they're like, are those things you want to talk about? And I will either say like, yeah, I'm ready to, or no, I think let's put a pin in it for another day. But yes, they're very open and they answer the questions that I want to know when I need to know them.
I'm so happy that you have this facility available to you, Flora. It's obviously a wonderful place, but unfortunately in the United States, there aren't that many hospice houses. They just really don't exist. And I think it's because of this common idea that everybody wants to die at home. And unfortunately, everybody doesn't get to just die in their sleep at 100 years old. So we do have to have these conversations about what choice looks like and what, you know, access looks like. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you have had the options that feel right to you. And I think that's just the key. That's key for any medical situation that anybody faces, but certainly the biggest ones like birth and death.
And also, I assume that a lot of people don't want to go into hospice because they think it means they're going to die in 2 weeks, where it's like, that's not true. You know, I mean,
but it could feel like it. It felt like it when I came here. I was like, am I just like everybody else is like, are you like here to die? And I'm like, no.
No, I'm here to get heart massages.
Yeah. I'm here because no one else would take me. And also the free cookies.
And the really good music, right?
Yes. But yeah, no, I agree. I think, and I hope in the future with kind of like people normalizing death in this culture, it will get, and death doulas and the practice, hopefully people will pay more attention to their own preparations for death and not be scared of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then maybe that will be like, oh, maybe we need more of these places, and that will affect some change. Knock on wood.
What's your death doula like your visits with that person?
That's just one of the things she does. The different ones that I've spoken with have studied different places. One person studied shamanism in Peru, and like she can give these like experiences where you like experience what it's like for your soul to leave your body and then come back, like, you know, like a guided astral projection. There's another person who just like can clear out chakras, and like you kind of like, it's like Reiki, but it's very deep. The other lady, the spiritual advisor lady, has like meditations that we practice so that like anchoring things. So like when you come to the time that you're transitioning, that you can go back to these mantras that you practiced and come to this energy and remember where it was and go to this space and feel safe in it because you've been to it before and you know what to expect, like kind of like making a pathway, things like that. That's what we've kind of talked about.
Are psychedelics legal in Vermont?
No, but
what's your address?
No,
I'm just kidding.
Oh, don't you? Yeah, I'm good.
I'm just kidding.
I'm good.
Fleur is winking suggestively. I think that's.
I've done a lot of work with PTSD and learning my path and expansion of the universe in my own way.
Yeah, that's something I'm super curious about. Is, you know, the future of psychedelics in death work
research? Yeah. Absolutely.
I would love to see more hospice houses and more hospice houses that incorporate psychedelics into the treatment that they give their patients.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I was working with for my pain management before I came here was the Vermont Cannabis Care Network, which is a nonprofit organization funded through a dispensary that provides no cost, low cost, donated weed from dispensaries to help people with their pain. So it's distributed to any cancer patient who has medical documentation of their illness. And we were one of the kind of like founding people who joined to help. I wrote some copy for their original pamphlets. I made them an intake form and helped her kind of launch a way to distribute information for them. And that is something that they started with like 14 patients. Now they have something like 74. If you look them up online, I can send you a link to what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll for sure link that in the show notes.
And unfortunately, because the federal and the state level have different regulations, they're limited in what they can do, but it has helped so many people. Like, there are some floors that allow that to be utilized. Like, the palliative care doctors will allow patients to bring in their own edibles as part of their pain management. And that has been so, so crucial for people, a lot of cancer patients, in ways that, like, there are people who got off opioids from utilizing pain tinctures and, suppositories, pain tinctures, edibles. It's been just such an important thing for the people who really needed it.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think we've kept you just about long enough, Flora. Is there anything else that you would like to say? How would you like to wrap up our interview?
I think I want to emphasize education and advocacy around the difference between hospice and palliative care, and that it's just as important to work on your spiritual, physical, and emotional healing as your physical healing. And that wellness is not something that you just obtain at one point. It's a kind of like a spectrum. There are going to be times where you are more and less well, and to not wait for a point in time to be better or worse to live your life, because you only really have the now. And if you wait, it's never going to come. This later never comes.
I can't imagine a better way for you to end the interview. Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
I'm just thrilled that this worked out. And thank you for everything that you've done for our podcast over the years.
Of course.
You're such a treasure in our community.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I've done much, but thank you. It's been a pleasure to watch you guys grow and expand and just to see this community be just what we needed. You saw the niche, you saw what people needed, you jumped in, and that takes courage and commitment to be fighting your own diseases too. Like, this is just, it's incredible. And I hope you realize that what you're doing is so meaningful and important too. If you ever doubt it, like, it's a game changer for me. It's been for a lot of people. Keep it up.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Flora.
I'm so glad that we got to talk to you.
Oh, wait, before you do go, will you tell us just a little bit about you, Flora, like in, you know, your normal life, the things that you enjoyed and hobbies and how you've spent your time?
I am a freelance creative kind of project manager person. I like to call myself a human librarian. So I like to connect people and resources. I love to read and write. I love comedy. People whisper. I really enjoy just being around people, although I'm an ambivert. I prefer to be behind the scenes in charge. I'm very, very like, I like to be a leader who's not in the spotlight. Puppet master.
Are you a Virgo?
No, I'm actually a Pisces Aquarius Brink cusp situation. Oh. But yeah, but I like to think I'm just kind of an alien.
Yeah.
But
I was going to say, that's a little chaos goblin.
Oh, I am a total chaos goblin. Yeah, you can tell by the purple hair. I am up to no good. 24/7. Oh, I give people shit. If I lose my sense of humor, you know something's really wrong. But yeah, that's me. I love people. I love helping them. I love causing a ruckus. I'm an enabler. I love animals, coffee, cooking, gardening, photography. I like it all. I love science. I'm just curious. I'm a curious human. And I would say that I'm a soul having a human experience, not a human having a soul experience.
So what a way to end it, right? Flora is just an absolute treasure.
Yeah, and we really want to thank her for coming on the show and sharing all of that with us.
Absolutely. One thing we did edit out is a conversation with Flora about her rehab facility. She did go into a lot of detail about what an unfortunate experience it was, which we thought was really interesting, but had to cut just due to time. But it's just fascinating to me that the rehab facility, which ostensibly is like a place of more hope and where you are expected to get better, was what did you describe it, Amy, as soul crushing?
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of like the stereotypical thing that you would expect. We just cut it just for time's sake. And there was just so much else in there that was just so much, I don't know, meatier and more interesting, I think. But we did want to at least give it a bit of time to mention, you know, but it was very stereotypical rehab facility stuff, you know, with overcrowding, understaffed. Patients were not getting properly bathed in the times that they should have been. People were not getting their food protocols. People were just, you know, it just was a super negative experience. And she said she was there for, you know, a small handful of months before she moved on to hospice, which ended up being, as you clearly have heard, such a breath of fresh air for her.
Yeah. And I'm so glad, but it just is a bummer that, you know, rehab and therapy places are not always very therapeutic.
Yeah. Some are, though. You know, I don't want to say that all of them, like if you're facing that in your future, I do not want you to think that, you know. We mentioned on a past episode of Cancer for Breakfast how my mom had to go into one of those facilities for like months, and walking in those doors, same thing, where it was just like same response as Flora. I just walked in thinking this place smells like shit, and like, would it kill them to paint the walls? Like, why can't it just feel a little bit better? And the outcome of her being there for a small handful of months is that I felt the exact opposite. The staff there cared so much, and she got such a high level of care and rehab. And, you know, now she's home and doing wonderfully and is better than before she went in, which is should be the outcome of rehab. But that was not what Flora received.
Yeah. So I hope you guys really loved this conversation, listening to it as much as we loved having it with Flora. Obviously, we love her, and all of our best wishes go with her in this period of transition. And stay tuned for that episode that we mention in the intro, the next episode of Cancer for Breakfast, where we talk about recurrence fears.
Yeah, and so much more. We've got some juicy stuff in that one, too, actually, in the cancer world.
Yeah. So thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you so much.
Hey, if you have any ideas for who we should talk to on an upcoming Second Opinion episode, please let us know. It's cancerforbreakfast@gmail.com. We won't always be talking about death, but we do have one coming up about aid in dying, physician-assisted dying, Act 39, death with dignity.
They call it different things in different places, but that's such an interesting topic and one we feel passionate about. So we're going to really cover that in one. We have different oncologists who we are going to talk to about various topics. One of them we have lined up to talk about alcohol and cancer, the real deal. But yeah, we want your recommendations too. What do you think would be cool? Who should we talk to? What topics should we cover for second opinion episodes in the future? Don't forget to like the podcast. Like it? What does that mean? Rate it. If you would please give us a 5-star rating or whatever you feel we deserve. It means so much to us. It makes such a difference. Thanks for listening to Cancer for Breakfast, our second opinion episode.
Goodbye.
Yeah, bye. We love you, Flora!
Cancer for Breakfast is hosted by Amy Dials and Stephanie Lejeunesse and produced by Nathan McGeehee. Our theme music is written and performed by Vivivir.
Find us at cancerforbreakfast.com, Instagram at cancerforbreakfast, and email at cancerforbreakfast@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening.